This is Dave Radlauer. I'm talking with Pete Clute about Clancy Hayes. Pete played piano for many years with the Turk Murphy Jazz Band and is author with Jim Goggin of The Great Jazz Revival, and knew personally and observed much of the West Coast traditional jazz scene, and knew personally a lot of the jazz musicians, including Clancy Hayes. Welcome, Pete. Good to have you back again.
Yeah, nice to be here.
So how was it you came to know Clancy?
Well, I first met Clancy, I was going to Stanford, and we had Bob Scobie and his band down to do a session at, a beer garden called Rosati's. And we had him down on a Saturday afternoon, and he came down with Ralph Sutton and Bob Scobie, and they did a performance. Cost us all of $150. That was in 1952.
This was for a frat, or
no? This was for Stanford itself. Mm-hmm. We were just having a party down there.
Now, you were already interested in traditional jazz and ragtime at that point, weren't you?
Yeah, I started liking the Waters Band. I guess it must have been about 1946 or 47. And I followed it pretty closely up until the time it went into Hambone Kelly's. And in 51, I started Stanford. And that's when I heard Clancy in person.
So tell me a little about the man.
It's hard to just... Clancy was a unique individual. He was a true troubadour, and he just loved what he was doing. Of course, I met him then, but I didn't really get to know him until he started working for us at Earthquake Magoons in about 1961. And we became, really quite close friends. And he was, a unique individual. He loved what he was doing. He wrote music. And he just loved performing, and that comes out in his songs. He was always billed as the voice of the South, and he started with KPO in San Francisco in 1928 or 29, and subsequently when KPO and KGO split, he went to KGO and had his own shows. But everybody loved him. He was just a... He's one of those unique individuals.
I think we'll both be more comfortable if you can actually see me. So yeah.
Okay.
Sounding fine.
Yeah, it is my impression that he was unique and multi-talented. Now he sang, he composed, and he played banjo.
He played banjo. He wrote his own radio scripts. He had one called The Tune Termites, which was himself and Glenn Hurlburt, who was a blind piano player, played in San Francisco for years. And he wrote the script and played all the parts, and Hurlburt played the piano behind him. I met him at Stanford, but then when Wally Rose was going to leave Turk, he tried to fix it up so that I would go with Scobie's band. And I went down there and was totally unprepared for what was coming on. I had played with various jazz bands of the amateur variety up until that point. This was about 1954. And I played with Scobie's band one day at the Tin Angel.
And this is when Clancy was there with Scobie?
Clancy was with Scobie, and I was just devastated. They played tunes in keys that I had never played the tunes in. And afterwards, Clancy said, don't worry about it. He said, you'll get a chance again, and, it'll be different then. Just keep doing what you're doing. And I became well enough acquainted with Clancy, and he used to tell me that I was one of the favorite piano players that he had backing him up.
So let's kind of break this down and take it one thing at a time. First of all, let's talk about his talents. So he had a lot of different, he played also, in addition to banjo, he played drums, I believe.
Yeah, he played drums and he played guitar.
Washboard, guitar,
uh-huh.
Piano.
Yeah.
Did he fool around with any of the horns?
Not to my knowledge.
And then he occasionally led his own ensembles.
Well, he would, he played a six-string banjo, and he always accompanied himself. And in a lot of songs that you'll hear him, it'll start out with a banjo cadenza or something to get into the tune, and then the band will come in afterwards.
Six-string banjo, isn't that unusual?
Well, he played it like a guitar, only it had a banjo head.
Was he using a guitar tuning?
That I don't know. Uh-huh. I would imagine so.
Mm-hmm. And it'd be a somewhat unusual instrument, the banjo, then, that he played.
Yeah, but it was good for somebody that was accompanying himself.
Mm-hmm.
And Monty Ballou used one.
So rather than playing just simple chords, he could play guitar tablature.
Yeah.
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 And he did often perform solo.
Oh, he did at the nightclub. When he left Bob Scobie in 61, then he came down and played intermission for us at Magoon's. And he was very happy to get out of Chicago. I remember one story he told me. He said, I knew the time had come when they found the owner of the nightclub 2 years later in the crook of a storm drain. And he said, well, it was just before that time that I figured I'd better get back to San Francisco.
And this is the 1960s, not the roaring 20s.
Yeah. Well, things were that way in New York, too, when we played there.
Uh-huh. So he did spend quite a bit of time there around Chicago, what, in the early 60s?
Yeah, I think about 59 and 60. Whenever Scobie went back there, he went with him.
Mm-hmm. And then at one point he stayed for a while and began working with the Salty Dogs?
I think he just did trips from time to time back to Chicago. I know he made a recording with the Salty Dogs.
That is a delightful record, and we'll be hearing just a little bit of that momentarily.
Yeah, I think that was later. I think that was in 63 or 64.
Mm-hmm. And Salty Dogs was a relatively, well, it was a young ensemble at that time. Weren't they college guys?
Yeah, actually, I think they started shortly after the war at Purdue.
Okay.
And
so they'd been going for some time then.
Yeah, and of course, the people in the band would change as they graduate from college. Pretty soon they got to the point where the same guys would play even after they had finished school. In fact, they're still going today.
Yeah, I talked to Wayne Jones recently, and he did have fond memories of working with Clancy, and I guess he wrote something for Mississippi Rag about recording with the Salty Dogs and their recording made with Clancy, which was apparently made just on the spur of the moment.
Yeah, I don't know what the arrangements were for the recording, but Clancy was always up to doing something on the spur of the moment. He loved to do things just sort of off the cuff, mm-hmm. and he was never at a loss for words for anything. And he knew every tune and the verses and the choruses to them, too.
Uh-huh. So it sounds like he was a very, very bright guy, a real character.
Well, I wouldn't say he was more of an individual than a character. Clancy was just Clancy. There's no way to describe him. And like I say, he loved his music and he loved having a good time.
So let's see, he over a period of about 25 or 30 years, was involved in traditional jazz. Let's see, he started with the early formation of Lou Waters' Yerba Buena Jazz Band?
Yeah, they used to go up to a place called Big Bear, which was in the Oakland Hills, and they'd go up there and just practice. And both Waters and Turk were tired of playing in bands that were just jam sessions, so they attempted to put together a band that would have more than one strain, that would have two and three and sometimes even four strains, and they would woodshed them and learn to play them up at the Big Bear Tavern. And Clancy would come up there. The sessions would start late in the night, and Clancy would come up after his radio shows, and they'd just have a jam session, but a more organized one, and usually with the same people all the time. That's where Wally started out with the Waters Band, and Clancy, of course, was there, and Turk.
And do you know how Clancy became acquainted with Turk and Lou and that bunch?
I think it was through the radio station. He was with KPO at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Clancy just loved the music, and he had this affinity for music of the South, and that fit right into what Waters and Turk were trying to do.
So the connection at the radio station would be that they were just all working musicians and in the same local and worked some of the same jobs, or was this... they worked on the air together, or does this go back to the Sweets Ballroom days?
I think Sweets Ballroom, Waters had a larger band, and he had an 8-piece band with the Waters Band originally, but before that he had a 12 or 14-piece band, and it just got too unwieldy for him, so he decided to have a smaller group. And Clancy was... one that brought some notoriety to Waters and the band. And Clancy...
because he was a more established musician at the time?
Well, he was a radio personality, you know.
In San Francisco.
Yeah, and actually it was good to have him with the band. You know, it opened up doors that normally wouldn't be opened.
And then at times there was some unorthodox approach to the rhythm in the Yerba Buena band. Didn't they have two banjos going for a while?
Yeah, Russ played.
At various times.
Russ played a left-handed banjo. I don't know if you knew Russ, but...
no.
He had one finger missing on one hand, so he...
oh, I didn't know that.
He played the banjo with his left hand instead of his right hand.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they had, well, it was strictly for a rhythm instrument. And Waters' idea was that it was okay to play loud. And if you had two banjos, you played louder and put down a more steady beat.
Then Clancy, during World War II, as many of the Yerba Buena guys served in the services during the war, Clancy, I think, was one of the ones that remained behind in San Francisco and was active in the Strickler version, the Benny Strickler version of the Yerba Buena.
Yeah, I think he played in the band when most of the Waters Band went into the service. Why Clancy didn't go in the service, I really don't know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then right after the war, things just took off with a bang.
Yeah, it took off with a bang. Do you want to get into the reasons they didn't stay at the Dawn Club?
No, I've been through all that before. I really want to focus on Clancy and his personality. So Clancy was involved in the great flowering of the late 40s,
yeah,
of the Yerba Buena Band.
And well, Clancy wrote a tune, I think it was in 45 or 46, called Huggin' and a Chalkin', which became very popular, and Hoagy Carmichael made a hit record of it. And that gave Clancy some notoriety, being the author.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, he was also with the Pacific Jazz Band. So...
what was the Pacific Jazz Band? Who was it, rather?
Oh, that was Jack Crook.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack Buck,
mm-hmm.
And I really don't know all the members of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think Jack Minger played in it,
mm-hmm.
And I don't remember the other people.
Okay. And then at some point, the Yerba Buena began to come apart. People began leaving and going in different directions, and Scobie was one who decided to have his own band.
Yeah. Scobie and Turk both decided, well, almost at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was about 1948 that Turk left the Waters Band, and I think probably just about the same time that Scobie did. Mm-hmm. And Clancy went with Scobie.
Uh-huh. And yet it seems like he remained on good terms with everyone.
Yeah, there wasn't any real reason to get mad at Clancy. Mm-hmm. He was always a side man, except with Scobie, he became kind of a partner, although he had nothing to do with the band, nothing to do with the workings of it.
That was my next question. A partner in the sense that he was a draw, or that he was he partly musical director? Did he contribute musical materials to the Scobie band? How did that work, do you know?
Well, Scobie's band was not quite as structured as Turk's band, and a lot of things were head arrangements, and Clancy would suggest what tunes he'd like to do, and Scobie would think up an arrangement, and they'd figure out who played where, and then they'd play it. With Turk, he pretty much wrote everything down.
Mm-hmm. And then it seems like Clancy had aspirations at some point to become a songwriter, to collect some royalties, to maybe have a wider success.
Well, I think after Huggin' and a-Chalkin', he wrote another tune called Wedding Day, and then he and Daphne got together, and they wrote 5 or 6 tunes. You wouldn't call them all traditional jazz tunes. They were just pop tunes of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think most musicians, especially at that time, you have to remember that traditional jazz as such wasn't called that. It was just another way of playing music. And Clancy, you know, was on the air practically every day, sometimes more than once a day in some capacity, and he liked notoriety. He wanted to become known as a songwriter, and mm-hmm. that was just part of his persona.
And the lifeblood of a musician is his popularity. Any funny stories you can think of about Clancy?
Yeah. Well, most of the funny stories have to do with drinking. I can remember one that when he was at Magoon's, there was a kitchen in the back, and off the kitchen was where we kept all the supplies and refrigeration units and that sort of thing. And Clancy always had a little Mickey of early times. And, of course...
Is that a bourbon or a whiskey?
Yeah, it's a bourbon. And... he would keep it behind some sugar crates or whatever was back there. So one day, or it wasn't one day, some of the guys, while he was on the stage, took his bottle and filled it with Worcestershire sauce. And after his stint was over, which was only 20 or 25 minutes, he'd go in the back room and take a big gulp of his early times, and it just about killed him with Worcestershire sauce. But
I bet he was mad as hell, too.
Yeah, he was. He couldn't laugh probably for an hour or so till somebody brought him a good drink.
Probably one of the few times in his life he couldn't laugh at himself.
He always laughed. He just, uh-huh. I mean, he'd get madder than heck, but, he'd calm down in 10 minutes, and then everything would be all right again. Uh-huh.
Can you think of any others?
Oh, I'd have to think a minute to think about it. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can get back to that.
Okay. So you were partner in the Magoon's Club in the 60s with Turk.
Yeah, right.
And Clancy played intermissions on and off over the years?
Well, we started Magoon's at 99 Broadway, and we stayed there for about a year and a half, and we were told we had to move. And that was just about the time Clancy was leaving Chicago. So when we moved to Clay Street, Clancy just took up residency, and he stayed with us for 10, almost 11 years.
Would he sit in with the band sessions as well?
No. What he would do is we'd play a set and then announce Clancy, and Turk put up on the side of the bandstand what he called a braille rail, so Clancy wouldn't fall off the bandstand. Clancy was drinking quite a bit at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Clancy could find his way to, and he had his, a seat that he'd come and sit at. And then he'd play for about 20 minutes by himself, and then he would announce that the band would come up and we'd join him in a tune.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we did make one ABC Paramount record with him. That was kind of a fun tune to do, or a fun album.
All his recordings seem to have a kind of a good time jazz, turn of the century saloon feel to them.
Yeah, Clancy was a true troubadour, and he just had that knack of being able to put a tune over. And Bing Crosby once said of him that he had the best way with words and the best phrasing of anybody he ever knew. And Clancy was just a one of a kind.
And he did have a very good voice. It was a very warm baritone.
Well, as a kid, for myself, it was one that I heard on the air, and it was unique. It wasn't like anything I'd ever heard before. He wasn't a crooner, and it was just happiness, just true happiness.
Mm-hmm. Now, you spoke of him as a man of the South, and yet it's my impression that he was born and raised in Kansas.
Yeah, well...
It's a border state, yeah. Admittedly, but...
Well, that's just how he... build himself as the voice of the South. I think he got
That was an actual moniker he used in publicity?
Yeah.
The voice of the South.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that he used it as much mm-hmm. as the radio station used it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, a lot of tunes and a lot of the music that Clancy liked came from the South. And being, like you say, a border state, a lot of the tunes... went through there on their way north.
One of the tunes he seems to have composed and rehearsed and played quite a bit was Parsons, Kansas Blues.
Yeah.
Kind of a railroad feel to it.
Yeah, I think, well, Parsons, I think, is where he is actually from. And there was the Katy line, which is in the song that runs through Parsons.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how long he stayed back there. I don't know. He came out to San Francisco in about 28. And he would have been in 28, he would have been 20 years old. So I don't know where he was the years before that.
Do you know if he was involved in music in the early days when he was in San Francisco, the very late 20s and early 1930s?
Well, when he was with KPO, he was.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Did he have a day job ever? Did you know that he ever had a trade?
That was his day job. He worked for a national broadcasting company.
Uh-huh.
And
so he always made his living as a singer, vocalist, performer.
Yeah, right. I mean, he must have done something before that, but I have no idea what it was.
Mm-hmm. Now, it seems that you have became acquainted enough with him that toward the end of his life or at the end of his life, some of his materials, tapes and so forth, ended up with you.
Yeah, well, I was a good friend. Aside from Clancy, I helped out his son, Bill, in getting reestablished after Clancy's death. And just his tapes and that sort of thing came to me because I was the one that might do something with them,
mm-hmm.
or preserve them, or get them in the hands of the right people.
Mm-hmm. But you knew Clancy in his declining years then.
Oh, sure. But when you say declining years, his cancer, when they took his jawbone and all.
Why don't we explain that briefly?
Okay, well, Clancy... Turk and I and Clancy would all go to the same eye, ears, nose, and throat doctor. And his name was Fred Fellows in San Francisco. And Fred, you didn't have to have an appointment. You just went to his office, and he pulled your tongue out and swabbed your throat and did various things, and you didn't catch cold and that sort of thing. Well, one day, Clancy went to him, and Fred found a spot under his tongue. And he said, Clancy, you better go take care of that. And of course, Clancy being Clancy, he didn't pay much attention to it till it was too late. And by that time, he had cancer under his tongue, and there wasn't anything they could do at that time except to operate, and they took his jawbone out and part of his throat, and I mean, it was really pretty awful. But his declining time probably wasn't over 2 years at the most.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a lingering, I mean, it was lingering, but it went fairly quickly.
And you say that he still actually sang a little bit, even with his jaw missing.
He would come down to Magoon's and sit there. He had to have a handkerchief in his mouth, because without a jawbone, your saliva would just drip out of your the glands, and he would keep that in his mouth before singing, and he would get up on the stage and sing a few songs.
Wow.
Yeah, he was game right to the end.
Wow.
It's really kind of hard to believe what people go through with things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But the end came fairly abruptly. I mean, he was in his home with his wife, and he said, "This is it." And he just died.
Mm-hmm. And he would have been, what, in his mid-60s or so?
Would have been 63.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an amazing story, and he's left an amazing legacy of music, both a lot of albums that were recorded, and he brought a lot of joy to a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
And we're lucky that people like you have collected a lot of the rarer materials that didn't make it to LP.
Well, I hope that maybe with your help we'll find some really unusual things in all this stuff, and bring out something that people can enjoy in the future.
There's certainly a lot of it. He just seems like he lived to perform.
Yeah, he just loved it. You asked for a funny thing that happened in his life. I remember once he used to drive. It seemed like the persona you had to have was to have a big Cadillac that showed success. And he had one that was a half a block long. But Clancy used to drink a lot, and he'd go home. He lived out on Balboa and about 41st Street, San Francisco, and it would take him sometimes 2 and 3 hours to get home. He would go so slowly in this huge Cadillac. Of course, if anything hit him, you know, he wouldn't have felt it, but he always seemed to make it.
I know banjo players sometimes get razzed about the instrument. If that cues any humorous stories, banjo's always a source of much hilarity. And
no, it always seems to be. Of course, you didn't really look at Clancy so much as a banjo player as a singer. He played the six-string banjo, which was more like a guitar with a banjo head, and he just used it as an accompaniment. And if you listen to some of his records, it sounds more like the banjo that was used in Old Man River, the old-fashioned kind that had a batter head instead of a plastic one.
Mm-hmm.
And it just had a really mellow sound.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't sound like a banjo band type of banjo.
Mm-hmm. And we do have a few recordings of him. In his own personal collection of tapes, there's some beautiful work with him singing solo with guitar.
Yeah, he played guitar, too. He had one of the larger guitars. See, the one that I have, I forget the size of it, but it was an Epiphone that was made about 1948. And so he must have gotten it a couple of years after Huggin' and A-Chalkin'. And he played that quite a bit. He never played it at Magoon's, I think mainly because of unamplified, it's hard to hear something like that.
Mm-hmm. Didn't project like a banjo.
No, and also it's a lot of work to cart it around along with a banjo.
Mm-hmm.
Banjo's more a show business type thing.
Well, it seems, I guess in summing up, which we've sort of already done, but in summing up about Clancy, I mean, he was a key player. He was somehow provided a kind of a gel in the bands that he was in, whether it was Yerba Buena or Scobie's band or the Salty Dogs.
Well, Clancy, well, in the radio business, he came to know a lot of very well-known people, you know, like Louis Armstrong and Jack Teagarden, and he liked that kind of music very much. And he knew all these people. And, you know, he talked to them on the radio. And he was a good bridge between the Chicago style of playing and the West Coast style of playing. Because he liked all that. He wasn't just in the Lou Waters mode. He liked
to swing. He liked to play 4/4.
Right. Yeah. I don't think many people realize that about him. But he was really at home with some of the really great musicians. He just fit in, you know, just like a glove.
He played with some of those outstanding musicians like Louis and Teagarden and Earl Hines in the Standard School broadcasts.
Uh-huh.
Do you know how that came about?
I think how that came about was Clancy was with NBC at the time. And, of course, he liked you know, traditional jazz, although they didn't call it that then. And he got the job of announcing the Standard School broadcast. And with Armstrong and Teagarden and Father Hines, he uses another name, but he also plays the guitar on that.